Here we go. Yep, yep, yeah. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We are live, doing our show live. We can't do best of, Sherry, because it always ends up Jacob going, hey, what do we mean by best? So we don't want to start getting into trying to define. It's not, you know what? It's like Buddha says. It's neither good nor bad. It just is.
That's right.
It just is. It just is. It just having in the day. Alrighty, as you just heard, Washington State's public school said they lost, where they said altogether, was it 39,000 kids pulled out?
39,000 fewer kids, yes, between October 9th of 2019 and October of 2020.
Yes. So parents got an opportunity to see what was happening in the class when they'd stand there and watch this ridiculous form of teaching through Zoom, where the kids weren't paying attention. The teachers would give the work. They couldn't really correct. There was just, it was not education, as we've seen already, that these kids are falling further and further behind. And some parents also got an opportunity to see the type of classwork that was being done. And they thought, you know what? This isn't for me. So of the 39,000 being pulled out of the public schools, are they going to private schools? Are they going, or it looks like, what percentage is going off to homeschool world?
A lot of kids are being homeschooled, but the Catholic schools have also seen an increase. So private schools overall, not so much, but homeschool has doubled in the state. And a lot of that is because, like you said, people don't necessarily like the curriculum that they saw. And some kids, when they got into the homeschool environment or they got into the pandemic type of environment where they had to be homeschooled with no choice, they liked it better. And the parents realized they could do this. They didn't feel intimidated by it anymore. This one woman in this Seattle Times article said she was one of those parents that said, I would never homeschool my kids. But once she had to do it, she realized that's probably a better option. The largest amount of the largest decline in schools was kindergartens. It dropped 14% enrollment in kindergarten. That's a lot.
Right. And that, by the way, does not bode well for the schools, because that's where it starts. You feed them into kindergarten. You feed them into first grade. That's the feeder. So when you see it drop there, that means it's not going to continue. Most likely will not stay on the same track unless the parents, this is what I'd seen from other times when public schools were losing students. They said what they look at is the influx, those coming in through the kindergarten program or the first grade. And if those numbers are down, then your first graders are down, your second, your third continues to sort of tumble all the way through. So it looks like taxpayers will not have to pay the $500 million, because for every student there is an attached dollar to it. I don't know what, I think it's $18,000 or 20-some thousand bucks to educate the kids. So $500 million will not be used. As I heard Dory talking about this the other day, then give the parents back the money. There are 32 schools in the United States that have voucher programs where they're anywhere between $4,500 up to $7,500, in some cases as much as $9,000, is given to the parent. You can say, here's your voucher. You can send your kid to any school you want. You're not locked into your zip code. You can go to the public school, the private school. You can go to this school or that school. There's your voucher. Go ahead. State of Washington does not have it, but other, again, 32 states have. And I wish we did have it here. Give the parent the voucher. Let them choose where the kid gets to go to school.
Well, they probably will have to go in that direction at some point, John, because it's up to 40,000 kids right now in the state of Washington being homeschooled. That's a lot. And so because of that, there may be some kind of an effort on the part of these parents to say, wait a minute, we're paying the same amount as somebody that's using the public school system. We deserve something.
Yeah, that is a weird thing. You know, you pay the money in on your taxes, and then you're paying for the public school, but you don't send your kid to the public school. You send your kid to the Catholic school. So now you're paying the $25,000 to send your kid to Eastside Catholic. Plus, they're also taxing you in order to send your kid to the public school down the street, right? So I sent Ryan to Eastside Catholic, and Lisa and I sent him there. We're like, look, there's all these great programs. You can be in this and that and that. There's a poetry and this, and you can be in band and everything. And just sign up for any of them. Get in there. Get in. If you don't get in, I'll give you one more year. If you don't take advantage of it, it's like a Ferrari. You never take it out of first gear. Then I'm not going to spend $25,000 to send you there. So we did 2 years, and then we're like, you're out. So he blew it there, because he could have been in band. You want to go to the trifecta of like super loserville in high school? Go band, but then also be on the football team, but knowing that you're not really going to get much playing time, but you've got to be out there at halftime in your uniform with your clarinet, right? I mean, that is the worst of the worst. You remember those kids?
Yeah, but doesn't the football player part offset sort of the nerdy band part. Like if you're a football player, no matter what you're doing, that's pretty cool as opposed to being in the band, which, you know, is okay, but not a football player.
Okay. So I think the clarinet takes you so far. You have such a deficit of coolness while you're licking the reed that you then it costs you so much. And then you're moving. Then you're thinking, okay, well, now you're going to split it in half and then he's going to be in his football uniform. But unfortunately, his pants are so unbelievably white because he never really sees any playing time. So he's got and he's not really big either. So he's got the clarinet plus he's got the super duper white pants on. So it doesn't offset and you still continue to be a nerd. But I mean, listen, a lovable nerd is you're out there forming a giant, I don't know, a jar or something, whatever they're forming out on the field for the Star Wars. I realize this is not fair. It's hitting too close to home because your dad played the tuba, French horn, clarinet. I can't remember what it was.
He played the coronet in the Redskins marching band, and I played the clarinet. Not in any marching band, but in elementary school, which I was terrible.
Yeah, I got it.
But my dad was good. My dad was actually a very good cornet player.
Speaking of music, what is the story saying that that Christmas music stresses people out and makes them upset?
Yeah, enough people, I guess, have said that Christmas music is so disturbing to them that there had to be an article about it and actually a poll about it. And Consumer Reports did a survey. 23% of people say that they dread hearing Christmas music. You know, this is the time of year when it's on everywhere, right? You can't really avoid it. 17% of shoppers say that they also dislike Christmas music. The group of people that seem to hate it the most are those that have to work in retail and hear it over and over and over again. And they say that's actually mentally draining to people when you hear it so often and you can't get it out of your head. And the reason is that a lot of times this music, whether depending on how you feel about the holidays and what your history was with your family and the things you went through, it can be really disturbing. It can bring up all kinds of terrible memories. I mean, if you didn't have a good Christmas or you're lonely or you're sad at Christmas time, the music doesn't cheer you up. It makes it worse.
Right. But I mean, that's for the I'm sorry. We have to cut you loose, you people that are upset, the 16.
You clarinet players.
The rest of you.
You marching band losers.
No, that's a no. We're moving on to the other people that are affected by the music. It's like, listen, the majority of people like the Christmas music, like to hear them, right? I mean, to them, it's okay. For the rest, they're going to be stressed out. You're really just complaining just to complain. You know what? You got other problems other than Christmas music.
Don't you think that we're getting into a situation where everything, I mean, this mental health thing has become such a huge subject all the time that everything affects somebody's mental health in a bad way, it seems. No matter how good it is, no matter how positive it's meant to be, it's still somebody's going to be upset about it nowadays.
Right, especially when you're asking a poll question. Everybody wants to seem special. Whenever we used to talk about these polls when I was on the city council, well, we polled these people. I mean, that's nonsense. They're only saying that so that you could pay attention to them. You know, does Christmas music affect you? If you're more interesting if you say yes than no, right? So then when the person goes, you know, how do you agree, disagree, strongly disagree? They ask you the 1-1 to 4, and you go, what's 4 again? Right, okay, so I strongly agree that Christmas music, and then the person, you get the person asking you the questions, you then seem more interesting. People are always just trying to be more interesting. So it's like they're deeply affected by this or by that, you know, that this is really upsetting to them. You know, suck it up. It's only on for another 10 weeks or something, however long they start playing this Christmas
music. At least it'll feel that way.
Right. So early. I was so into Christmas when I was a kid that on Christmas Eve, I took my saxophone because I played in the band, and I would go outside and play Little Drummer Boy, Oh Come Holy Faithful. I did like 6 songs, one right after another, Winter Wonderland. And I remember just because it was outside, it was cold, I'm standing there just blasting this saxophone. And Mrs. McAdoo, who hardly ever said anything to anybody because she was often drunk, I heard her open the door and yell, "Stop it!"
I thought that was going to go where she finally came out and gave you a small piece of candy. Not a chance. Mrs. McAdoo.
And I tell you, I was good on all of those Christmas songs because we used to march in the Christmas parade and the New Year's Eve or the New Year's Day parade in Philadelphia. So I knew all those songs, and I was good, and I sounded fine. And
did
she
did you dress as a clown in that parade?
No,
and play the saxophone.
No,
okay.
No.
All right,
you wore your fancy pants. You know, you wore your fancy
band uniform.
Band uniform with the big feather on the top of the thing.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Good to know. Good to know that getting a chance to relive the horrors of playing the saxophone for Mrs. McAdoo. Thank you for bringing that back for me. By the way, why are people late? This is a fun story, is that they're looking to see, find out more people are late and why some people are on time. You were confessing earlier in the pre-show meeting that your husband apparently has a bad habit of being late often.
Well, it's interesting about him because he's former military. You know, as I've mentioned, he went to West Point. So he's a very fastidious guy. And for the most part, he is super type A, right? I mean, he's never everything has to be just so. But when it comes to us leaving on time, it seems as though we can never get it together. And he always adds one more thing to do. I have to say, I am very forgiving about a lot of things. But I am really a stickler about people being on time. I get really annoyed if you're late. Everybody has a mishap now and again, but we all have those friends, right, that are chronically late. And this article is sort of it's supposed to make you feel differently about it. This cognitive therapist says that most people don't do it deliberately, but they're a lot of them are what she calls natural-born optimists because they believe fully that they can get everything done. They really have such an optimistic attitude that they think that they can get all this stuff in on time and still show up for lunch when they're supposed to. It's not that they're inconsiderate. It's not that they don't value other people's time. It's that they're optimists. Or some people – yeah, exactly.
I see. So they're able to get everything done just before leaving the house and then realizing they didn't get everything done. And now they're 10 minutes late.
Yes. And she says that a lot of them are overschedulers, so that they may just put too many things in one day. And some are chatty. So they chat too much at one appointment and that makes them late for the next appointment. But she says that you really, if you have a friend like that, that shows up late all the time, you need to try to understand them and ask them how you can help.
I think it's one of these things where I always thought it was a power play. Like the person is showing up late, it's because they're showing you, I don't come here on time, I don't need to, and you guys are all going to have to wait for me.
Right, right. I think it's that too. I think it's that too. And well, she says some people make it part of their deal, right? Like that's just who I am. I'm just going to be late. I have no tolerance for that. I have a real problem with it.
That's the person that shows up at the meeting. Everybody else is already sitting there and they come in like they've come through a tornado or they've crawled through a sewer pipe. They've got like everything's all over the place. Their laptop is falling out and their hair's all screwed. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Think about this. I couldn't find a parking spot there.
Right. They're a victim all of a sudden. Yeah.
Like, I'm a nice shoe. I couldn't shoot that. There's a dog. My dog. And you're like, and no one cares about any of the excuses. None of them. None of them. Right.
Else managed to get there fine, and they have to, and of course we're all supposed to feel sorry for them and forgive them and be like, oh, it's okay, I get it. No, it's hard. I'm sorry.
Nope.
Wow, that's tough.
Nope.
Yeah.
And one more childhood story. My father used to pick us up. My mom would sometimes not be able to pick us up. This is coming out of St. Aloysius Academy. My brother and I played football and basketball and baseball there. And everywhere, once in a while, my mom would say to us, I can't get you after school. Your father's going to come get you. And you must be outside when he shows up. And it was like, I don't know, 5:30 or whatever. Practice is over. You have to be outside when he pulls up. Because my father used to say, hey, I got news for you. I'm a bus, not a cab. I'm a bus, not a cab. And when he elongates a short word like cab, I am a bus, not a cab. Then you knew he's not a cab, right?
And the difference business.
Didn't need to explain it. I just said, Chuck, don't forget, Dad's a bus, not a cab. Right? So we would be in there goofing around, like after football practice, goofing around with the kids, you know. And then all of a sudden, we would see my father pull up. Right? I'd look out there, I'm like, Chuck. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, Dad's here. And he'd just see him pull up. He'd wait like 5, 4, 3, and then just drive away. And then it's gone. He'd go back home. Yep. And then we'd call, borrow a dime from somebody. Mom, Dad came and went. She goes, well, I guess you guys are walking home. I'm walking home like 6 miles at 5:30 at night on the side of Bryn Mawr Avenue. I'm just like, this is little or no regard. I mean, it was like something from National Geographic where you'd see people on the highways just thinking at home with a distended stomach. Chuck, you got a fly in your eye. I'm too weak to bat it away. Yeah. Oh.
And you'd come home to your sister with the broken arm that didn't get fixed.
It's like 7:30. Dinner's gone. My mom. I mean, we were like 7th and 8th grade. Never forget that. I am a bus, not a cab. Twice the bus came and went.
And you should, and you just got home and your dad said, should have taken a cab.
Yeah. All right. Josh Kearns, anybody out there in a cab?
They're on the bus.
I guess it has become a Thanksgiving tradition that I call my brother on the phone from Philadelphia, and we do the Thanksgiving story, the curly Thanksgiving story. Chuck, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
Well, listen, this has become a tradition that we have told now. This story we have told for almost 20-some years. Can you believe that? In Seattle, where I would often call you at your work, you would be there as a lawyer, and you'd have to close the door of the big firm that you're working at because you would then have to play the part of Aunt Seal, which involved a lot of coughing and choking.
That's true, although originally I was only on for a moment to verify that the story was true.
And then what happened?
And then later I somehow was given a part.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's all fuzzy. Are you okay? Don't move around. Where are you? Are you on some sort of landline, or what are you doing?
I got a landline that I never use. Maybe is it better? Is it still bad?
It's better. Don't move around.
All right.
Do you need to move around to play Aunt Seal?
No, not at all.
Okay, let's get started. You ready?
Yes.
Cue the music. Aberdale Road. Where an enormous maple tree stood on a small patch of now faded green grass. Giant leaves, crusty, twisted, and unraked, sat underneath the tree. We would pull up to 38 Aberdale Road, where my grandmother and grandfather had lived for as long as anyone could possibly remember. We would arrive late. All the good parking spaces were already taken. We would get out of the station wagon, race across the road, dance and sing, turning around in a circle, kicking through the leaves that were left below. "Come on," my father would say. "Come into the house." With that, he would open the door. Giant waves of blue, yellow, and seemingly green smoke would pour, bellow, puff out from the door, the front door. Almost as if there was a tire fire inside, or a dock fire, or something else, maybe like a railroad car waiting at a station. Giant puffs of steam would pour from the door. It wasn't smoke from a turkey, or a ham, or stuffing, or gravy, or something else. It was smoke blown from the lungs of tired old Irish people that smoked, smoked hard, smoked heavily. Everything coming out of the house was nicotine and other types of carcinic devices that were pouring from their lungs. Someone would yell from inside 38 Aberdale Road, "Hey, close the door! You're letting the smoke out!" And with that, Uncle Frank would laugh. His laugh started like an old two-stroke engine trying to kick over a start of oxygen but plenty of gas. It would rattle and rattle and rattle along until finally it ended with lots of wheezing and coughing. Uncle Frank was the first chain in the cough of chains that would then fill the house with smoke, laughter, and lots of coughing. We would turn our heads like people that were learning to swim for the first time, and we would turn just gently to the right to grab one more intake of fresh air before entering the house. "Get low," my mom used to say, laughing. We would get low because that's where the good air was, down below. And every once in a while, we would reach up and grab our hands into ashtrays that seemed to be put all throughout the entire living room. And the ashtrays were full of cigarettes. And we would take each one of
the cigarette butts onto the floor where the kids would play around, crawling around like army men. We'd have the cigarettes and we'd shoot at one another. And every once in a while we'd yell, "I got you, I got you." And then another child would yell out, "Nope, can't shoot me, because my name's Lucky." If you got the cigarettes that said Lucky on it, it was like a special little prize that only you could have and you could put it in your pocket. But then when you realized as you pushed yourself up through all the smoke, there were lots of cigarettes that said Lucky, because that was the brand that most of the Curlies smoked. "Has she arrived yet?" Uncle Frank would say. "Not yet. I think she's taking the number 19 bus. The 19 bus would come down on Bryn Mawr Avenue and park right in front of St. Matthew's Church. And that was the bus that Aunt Seal was on. She was carrying her gravy that she was so proud of, the 89-year-old woman, unmarried, but yet married in a way to that gravy, because it was something special that every year that she would make. It would often have an oily sheen on the top layer. It was a congealed fat that, if not stirred or gently tossed from side to side, it would harden up like a recently extinguished candle. And inside the gravy, you could see bits of real egg. And Aunt Seal would say, "It's made with real egg." And we'd all go, "Is there anything other kind of egg than other than real egg, Aunt Seal?" It was a rhetorical question, but it was one that was often said and asked and answered over and over again. Finally, the door opened up, and through the door she came, carrying her gravy. It was in an old porcelain container. And there it was, and she'd walk through the door, and she would declare,
"Mucus weighs more than fat."
That's what she'd say. We'd try to ignore the mucus comment, and she'd come in with her gravy. We knew once she'd arrived with it, Thanksgiving was right around the corner. She'd put it down at the table, and my mom would say, "All right, everybody, up off the floor, put down those cigarette butts, and come on in." And we'd all scurry, staying as low as we could, scampering like army men, away from clouds of yellow smoke, up to the table. There would be at least 30 people seated at the table. Grandma would be in the other room, and so would Granddad. "Where are my dish towels?" he'd say. "I'll get them for you." I often volunteered to get the dish towels because I knew in the same cabinet the dish towels were kept were also gumdrops, and I would steal a couple of gumdrops along the way. I found the minty-flavored ones had a way of sort of clearing my throat that had become parched and torn by having to inhale so much cigarette smoke. "Here are your dish towels, Pop-Pop." I called him Pop-Pop. "There you go. Thank you." He'd rub my head, and I could smell the tobacco stains on his finger sort of digging into my young tossed hair. He would then take 30 dish towels. He'd place them on the table at the head of the table, and the turkey would come out. And the turkey would sit there at the front of the table, and it was Pop-Pop, Grandma, and then to the right of them, Aunt Seal. Aunt Seal leaned in, took a big whiff of the turkey, and said,
"Where are my cigarettes?"
That's right. Aunt Seal wanted to know where her cigarettes was. So she would reach down, she'd take out her purse, and she'd open up the purse, and she'd take out her cigarettes and declare,
"Well, here they are, and I was so afraid because I thought I left them on the bus."
She hadn't left them on the bus. With that, she'd hand out cigarettes that anybody would want them, and everyone would take another puff of Aunt Seal's cigarettes. They were longer, they were thinner, more delicate, and more ladylike, she said. Sometimes the longer cigarettes just make you look more fashionable, and then everyone would laugh and cough at the same time. Aunt Seal's gravy was ready to go, and so was everyone else. And with that, my grandfather said,
"Now, listen, everyone. When I hand you a dish towel, I want you to wrap it around your face as tightly as you can. No cheating this year. I know some of the cousins cheated last year."
We take out the dish towels and we tie them tight around our eyes to make sure that nobody would see. And then Pop-Pop would go around and take a piece of meat, a small piece of meat, and put it on your plate. And he'd say,
"Brown wheat, brown meat, or white meat? Brown meat or white meat? You get what you get and you don't complain and you eat what you eat.
You understand? Because, see, Pop-Up believed that brown meat and white meat tasted exactly the same, and the only way they could convince you was to blindfold you with a dirty, stinking dish towel. So everyone sat around yelling out, "Brown meat! White meat! I've got brown meat! Wrong! You got white meat!" My grandfather would say he'd snap back to attention to make sure that you ate the brown meat that he put in front of you. He knew exactly what he gave you, and he was only going to give you what he gave you. "Brown meat! I got brown meat! I think this is white meat." "Ah, it's brown meat. You're getting brown meat." You'd take off your dish towel. All of a sudden, with all the laughter, the screaming and the yelling, the laughing, the coughing and the smoking, nobody heard Aunt Seal when she leaned forward, and it sounded like she was coughing for just a moment, and then she gasped back, but there was so much laughter. "Brown meat, white meat, brown meat, white meat." There was no one who was paying attention to Aunt Seal. What had happened to the old woman? I heard her breathing hard, hard, but "brown meat, white meat." "Hang on, everybody. I got plenty more where this came from, and don't be cheating. Don't be cheating." No one heard her. It sounded like she was saying brown meat. What was wrong with her? Somebody? Someone? Aunt Seal? We'll be right back with the Curly Thanksgiving story right after this. It was Thanksgiving at 38 Aberdale Road. Everyone had arrived, all 30 of the relatives. They knew the tradition that my grandfather would blindfold everyone, determined that there was no difference between brown meat and white meat. And the only way that he could prove it was to make sure, when he put a small piece of meat at your plate, you couldn't tell by looking at it, only by taste. So many of us were tricked. I don't know whether it was the smoke in the room or the tightness of the dish towel or the moldy smell of the dish towel, but often all you wanted to yell out was white meat or brown meat. You had a 50-50 chance of getting it right, and what did you really care in the end? But this was the tradition at the Curly household. "Brown meat, white meat, brown meat. No, wrong, you're getting white meat. No, wrong, you're getting brown meat." It wasn't a tradition, and it was part of our lives. Except on one particular Thanksgiving. With everyone yelling and screaming with their dish towels tied tightly around their face, no one heard Aunt Seal, who was so proud of the gravy that she would bring. It was thick and juicy and had bits of real egg in it. She kept it right in her lap. She had fallen into it, face first. It started to congeal around her old lady rouge cheeks like a desk death mask. We were so busy yelling. Listen, it can't blame anybody. And I'm not blaming anybody, but everybody had a blindfold on. People were yelling and screaming. I mean, the fact that the old lady had fallen into the gravy, who would have thought something like that? But the fact that we thought she was saying brown meat. Brown meat. White meat. We thought she was just playing along. White meat. And then finally, the old lady gave off one more exhalation before the gravy hardened around her face. Hey, something's wrong with Aunt Seal. We all took off our mask, and we looked over, and there she was, face down in the gravy. The real bits of egg had seemed to form around her eyes as well. There was no way. I don't care even if she was 14 years old, she'd be able to escape something like that. It had like a suction-like effect upon her. We pulled her face up from the gravy, and she was not there. Quickly! Onto the living room floor. I remember the old lady laying there. I remember the red lights from the ambulance turning, filling the room with redness and darkness, and then redness and then darkness.
and the EMTs worked on her. They kept all the kids in the other room because nobody wanted to see what was happening. Red light filling the room, and then to darkness again. The muffled sounds of adults trying to calm the kids. The sounds of the ambulance guys going about their business. There was a clicking sound, and then a whoosh as the ambulance and the gurney lifted the tired old lady's bones onto it. They put a sheet over her and pushed her out the four steps down the front of 38 Abbeydale Road, through the maple leaves, and into the back of the ambulance. Uncle Frank lit a cigarette, blew the smoke into the air, and said, "Well, at least the old girl died doing what she wanted to do. Choking on a piece of white meat." And my grandfather said, "Nope. Not so fast, Frank. It was brown meat." And that is the Curly story, as it's been told, handed down from generation to generation, that Aunt Seal and her beloved gravy, their tradition of trying to determine the difference between brown meat and white meat, would be the end of this sainted lady.